Today's episode is actually a recording of a talk given to GiveDirectly by the Oxford economist Dennis Egger. He's an expert in the idea of economic spillovers that come from cash, giving out cash in a large amount in very poor areas like Kenya, actually grow the wider economy and allow for more spending and growth without causing inflation. His own theory and paper on slack is the idea that there's enough slack or space in the economy that businesses and small traders can absorb this new cash without creating price inflation or labor inflation. It's a very interesting talk, so I'll turn it over to Dennis.
So this is a paper about slack and economic development. It's sort of a bit, sort of a broader theme, but as you'll see, essentially it'll feature GiveDirectly cash transfers very, very heavily, because we're going to use these as a sort of, application of this model, or sort of as a motivation for this model. So what is slack? Slack is sort of the underutilization of factors of production, or sort of idle capacity. This could be both in labor or in machines. So machines that are there, but they're not operating all the time, or workers that are there, but are basically not working or doing anything productive. For example, they're waiting, they're sitting around sort of because there's not enough demand to fully sort of utilize their work time. And this is a really old hypothesis that has gone back to at least sort of the Lewis model, for those who know it, that, you know, basically says this is a feature of developing country settings or poor economies. But what we didn't know is that this actually is true in contemporary data. So if you sort of just plot capacity utilization, which basically comes from a question in the manufacturing survey where you ask firms, you know, how much could you, with the existing workers, no, existing overtime, existing machines, how much could you maximally produce and how much are you actually producing? You see this sort of utilization in rich countries is around 80%, in sort of poorer countries, and in our data in Kenya as well, it's more around 60 to 70%. And we sort of want to bring back this old idea and sort of derive the aggregate implications of that for sort of economic policy and understanding sort of economics in developing country settings. So why is slack important? So the first point we want to make is that it's a direct cause of lower productivity or lower incomes, right? So if you could take a Nigeria here from sort of 55-60% utilization to 80%, that would be a 30% increase in productivity. With the same workers and the same machines, they would produce 30% more output, and therefore their incomes would go up by 30%. So it's a direct cause of poverty. But it also implies elastic aggregate supply curves. And let me sort of disentangle this term a little bit. An elastic aggregate supply curve means that supply or output or sales in this economy can increase quite costlessly or quite easily without prices going up a lot. So elastic just means a flat supply curve, or a very sort of shallow supply curve. And why does slack imply that? Well, you know, suppose you're underutilized, you're sitting around for 10, 20% of the time. Now you face more demand. Well, you can just work 10, 20% more. You don't have to raise wages or hire more workers or buy another machine, because you're sort of not already using what you have at full capacity. And that is really important for sort of demand side policies, which include cash transfers, right? So cash transfers or government stimulus or any other types of programs that inject or increase demand in an economy are now going to have larger multipliers when there's a lot of slack, because supply can basically match or increase to meet that additional demand quite easily without having to raise prices. And this is sort of also part of the motivation for this paper, because, you know, our analysis of the GiveDirectly program in Kenya, the sort of general equilibrium impacts of that, which I hope you know, but I'll get back into this in more detail later, as well as after that, some other papers have shown that sort of multipliers tend to be larger in developing country settings, larger than we see them, for example, in the US and other places. And this is sort of one reason for why this is. Now, despite the sort of, you know, the big cross-country patterns and the sort of big implications, there isn't really in economics or contemporary modern economics sort of empirical evidence of this at the micro level. So how do you even measure slack? Can you document it? We're going to try to set out to do that. There isn't also what we call a theoretical micro foundation, or a sort of a reason for why there might be more slack in these settings. There's a ton, and you know, I would say some of them borderline racist theories of why there might be more idle labor, underutilized labor, surplus labor. This is sort of what Lewis called it back in the day. But those are basically hypotheses or conjectures. They aren't really sort of grounded in a sort of empirical model where people sort of act optimally or rationally. And that's what we're also going to try to do in this paper. So what are we doing? We're sort of thinking about this paper about the micro causes and the macro implications of this underutilization in small firms. Why small firms? Well, we're going to show that, this underutilization is much more prevalent in small firms and in developing country settings, such as the ones that you guys work in predominantly. There are just a vast majority of firms are very, very small, and therefore that might be a reason for why we should think about this as sort of quantitatively mattering for the macroeconomy. So we're first going to sort of document that there is this underutilization using various different types of measures that we've developed, and that it's more prevalent in small firms in sectors with what we call have lumpy inputs. So inputs which are sort of bulky. You have to buy one big grain mill or one tractor, or you have to hire one worker for the whole day. You cannot just hire them for 5 minutes. And it's more prevalent in thin markets. What do we mean by thin markets? Well, markets that are remote, rural, with high transportation costs and have low demand generally. It also holds more in the lean season and in sort of, low times of the day. We're then going to sort of, based on these facts, try to motivate a sort of spatial structural model that rationalizes, basically why these facts occur, but also then what the implications of this are for sort of GDP or the impact of cash transfers and stimulus in general equilibrium. So what we're going to show is that, what we're going to introduce in this model is this idea of an integer constraint. This is what I meant by lumpy inputs. So two typical examples in our Kenyan settings are, for example, a barber shop, where basically you have to be there all day waiting for customers, or you stay at home in your village and work on your farm for the whole day. And so it's sort of this micro enterprise choice of, do I go to the market for the whole day? And then however many people come, whether it's 20 or 40 or 30, I have to be there and wait all day anyway. But I cannot just go for 2 hours or 30 minutes because of high transportation costs. Another typical example is sort of a grain mill. It's the most predominant form of manufacturing in our setting. Every village has one, or also called posho mills for those who work in the region. But they run 4 or 5 hours a day, maybe in every village. They could easily run 6, 7 hours, but still somebody has to be there and sort of serve customers most of the day. And that sort of already gives you sort of an intuition for where slack is going to come from, right? You're going to hire one worker, even if you're not going to fully utilize that worker. You're going to need a machine for the village, even if you're not going to run it all the time. And so what this sort of is going to give us is in the model, we're going to have these convex aggregate supply curves. So what does that mean? It means that over some range, the supply is very flat, which means output or production can increase very easily without prices going up. And then at some point it gets steeper and steeper and steeper. The intuition is more and more and more firms are going to hit their constraint. They're going to work full time, and the machine is going to run 8 hours, and they're going to need a second machine or a second worker. And when they do that, they can only do that by sort of basically raising prices. And so, as we put more and more money into an economy, or so the economy gets closer and closer to urban, we're going to have steeper and steeper supply curves. It's going to help us understand in the model, and it's going to explain why we see these large demand multipliers. And it's going to make this point basically that in these types of economies, maybe demand is the most important constraint for development, right? You can, when the supply curve is flat, you can like give business training and productivity increases for firms as much as you want. If they're already not using the productive capacity that they have to the maximum, if you now increase that capacity, that's not going to raise output at all. What you need is demand stimulus, and I'm sure you guys are going to love hearing that. Okay, so we're going to then take the model, and this is the part that's going to be really interesting for you, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on that, to apply it to the large-scale unconditional cash transfer RCT with Gift Directly, the GE study that we did in Kenya. And we're going to sort of basically estimate the model on that data, and we're going to replicate the exact experiment in the model and show that the model replicates what we found empirically relatively well. And that just sort of basically is a validation strategy for the model. So now we can use this model and tell you, what would happen if we did this in an urban setting, or what can we say about the full distribution of the welfare impacts across every village, not just on average, right? The RCT just gives you the average increase and not the increase for every village. In the model, we can trace that, we can trace that out. And we can give you some insights into, how should you target these policies, when are multipliers large, when are they small? And I really would love to get your input at the end here and talk about that. Okay, so before we get started, any questions?
I don't see any question in the chat. No, I think we can continue, Dennis. Thank
Yeah,
you.
I just looked at it and it's mostly note takers, AI stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, all good. All right, so let's get started. So I'm going to give you some descriptive statistics on Slack in Kenya. Then I'm going to sort of very quickly go through the model again, how we estimate it. And then I'm going to spend the bulk of the time on the GiftDirectly RCT because I'm sure you guys are most interested in that part. Okay, so how do we do this? It's kind of hard to measure utilization. In particular, it's hard to measure it for firms outside of manufacturing and for these sort of small non-agricultural enterprises that you see in developing country settings. And so we had to sort of develop both a sampling frame and a sort of new way of measuring this in this data. So we're going to do this for over 5,000 non-agricultural enterprises. So this is not about farms. This is about non-agricultural retail, manufacturing, artisanal work, restaurants, hospitality, these kind of firms in both rural Kenya. This is going to be Siaya County, where the GE study took place, and the capital, sort of four very, very busy markets in Nairobi, to give you a contrast of rural versus urban areas. So what are these rural markets? These are all 71 weekly markets in Siaya County. This is a sort of typical rural sub-Saharan African setting where 70% of consumption expenditure is on food. This is very typical, I guess, also for GiftDirectly recipients. Agriculture is the main production of this region, and most of this is exported. Everything else is pretty much imported. So the rest is sort of a retail and service economy, we call it. It's sort of buying food and selling it. Small restaurants, food stalls, posho mills, grain mills, barber shops, retail stores, carpenters, motorcycle taxis, and so on. So it's sort of either everything is sort of can be characterized either as sort of retail or services. Even the manufacturing firms in our setting are sort of carpenters that work on demand or in an artisanal way. You go there, you describe what kind of door you want. It's kind of a bit like a service. It's not, you shouldn't think of this as large manufacturing firms. These settings are also characterized by high transportation costs. So almost everybody walks to the closest market. Closest market is about 30 minutes away, the next one, 1.5 hours. So relatively high transportation costs. And this is the universe of all firms, right? This is not a sample. This is sort of all firms operating in this entire county, 90% have zero employees, are one-person firms. So this is just already going to tell you how important it is to understand these microenterprises and small firms, because basically the entire economy or non-agricultural economy in this setting are small firms. Urban markets are different. So basically what we did is we asked basically our numerators and people we know who live in Nairobi, sort of where people typically shop. So these are going to be daily busy central markets with somewhere between 1,500 and 6,000 vendors. Again, despite their large size and how busy they are, there's a lot of sort of very similar small firms right next to each other. So 20 carpenters doing exactly the same thing next to each other. If you're a food vendor, there's 500 other food vendors in the same market. If you're a barber, there's 14 others. And all of these are still relatively small. They're larger than in the rural areas, but still 75% of them are one-person firms. And so it seems to be true that even in urban settings, in these sort of daily markets, small firms are a large share of the total production. And therefore, again, quantitatively, we should take seriously this idea that, small firms may have more slack and face these sort of integer constraints. Okay, so in these representative settings, the rural and the urban ones, we're going to measure slack or underutilization in different ways. So first, we're going to just replicate the survey question that I've already showed you. We're basically going to ask, typically it's the owner of the enterprise, how much with your current workers, your current machines, everything, how much could you maximally sell and how much are you actually selling? And we sort of find, as I showed you, a utilization of sort of 60%, which is sort of lo much lower than what you would find in the US. We also, and this because it may be difficult for these enterprises to estimate what would be the maximal production, we also just asked them, what was the most you ever sold in any of the best week in any of the weeks last month? And we're going to take that as sort of the estimate of maximum capacity. And so in the worst week in a month, they sell only 37% of the best week. So at least over some time, again, they're underutilized. They could be selling more. For labor, we basically sat in front of businesses for an hour. We picked a random employee and we sort of every minute we noted down what they're doing. And 50% of the time, they were not doing anything obviously productive. Maybe they were thinking about stuff in their head about the business, but certainly it wasn't looking like they were doing anything productive. In Nairobi, this was much higher, right? 83% of the time they were being serving customers or doing stock arrangement or something like that. Machines operate only 7% of the time. So the way 70%. So the way we did this is sort of we asked firms about all of their machines and tools and equipments and vehicles, and then how many hours they operated in the last working day. And then lastly, we asked sort of about marginal costs. This is going to be important in the model. The marginal cost basically is how much would it cost you to sell 10% more of your most sold product? So if you do haircuts and you did 10 haircuts today, how much would it cost you to do one more haircut? Think about it. You know, would you have to get additional materials, inputs, maybe extensions, maybe, you know, would you need more scissors? Think about all of that. And strikingly, for sort of 30% of firms in rural settings, they say it would cost me nothing to sell 10% more. In urban areas, again, that's lower at 17%. So what we're now going to do is sort of, instead of showing you evidence for all of these different measures, we're going to just combine them into one index that summarizes them. They're all correlated, fortunately, and all of what I'm going to show you works for each of the different components. But for to sort of ease the exposition, I'm going to show you just an index. Okay. So what are we going to show you? Well, the first fact I've already showed you. You know, basically, there's more slack in poor economies. So, you know, low-income economies have lower utilization on average. Next, I'm going to show you that small firms have lower utilization on average. So here you sort of see that firms which are smaller to the left have lower revenue on average, also have lower average utilization, and larger firms have higher utilization, right? So basically making the point that slack is a problem for small firms. Another way to say this is its utilization is significantly lower for these one-person micro enterprises than it is for enterprises that actually have some employees. Okay, so really, this phenomenon, to the extent that it matters, should be able, or we should be able to explain why it is a bigger problem for smaller firms. Okay, it is also a bigger problem in more remote places or in remote markets. So here we're sort of showing you utilization, either sort of holding sector and firm size fixed. So even conditional on the size of the firm, we're going to show you utilization in enterprises or firms that operate from the homestead. So you're a tailor, you work at home, and you also sell some clothes in the village, right? Maybe the local grain mill in a market. So this is these rural weekly markets that I described to you, the 71 markets, or in Nairobi. And you sort of see a monotonically increasing utilization. The more urban, the more busy, the larger a market gets, or the sort of closer a market is to its demand or its customers, the more it's sort of the factors of production are being utilized. Okay. It is also true, and I'm just going to click quickly on this, and it's not working, but it is also true that slack is lower in the sort of low season or sort of and there's more utilization after the harvest, for example. And lastly, in which sectors is this a problem? So this is again the utilization index. Utilization is highest in sort of hospitality, food, and retail, which potentially is because you can better plan demand, or demand is more regular, or there's just more customers buying these kind of things. Whereas in personal services and manufacturing, We have the lowest utilization. And this is the examples that I gave you, right? It's the sort of the post-show meal, the carpenter that's waiting for people to come and order a door. It's the barber shop that needs to wait there for customers. And so again, to the extent that we want to understand this phenomenon, we want to understand why it's bigger in these sectors that have these lumpy inputs, where you sort of basically you have to man the shop or you have to have at least one machine. And that's sort of why we're gonna sort of model this as integer constraints. So I hope I've sort of convinced you up to now that Slack varies with development and there's more Slack in developing country settings. And within developing country settings, it is associated with factors that are typically present in these countries. So there's bigger and small firms, there's more Slack in sectors with lumpy inputs. Where you have these sort of discrete choices of how much to invest into buying or purchasing either workers or machines, and in remote markets with high transportation costs. So based on this sort of idea, we're now going to introduce this idea of this lumpy input in small firms in a spatial general equilibrium model. So what does that general equilibrium bias or the space bias? Well, basically, we want to model this over space. To sort of approximate this idea that some markets are more remote than others. And we want to also model it over space so that we can replicate what happened in Siaya County with the gift directly transfers and sort of really sort of play out this program through the model. Why general equilibrium? So general equilibrium just means that we're going to model the entire economy. We're not going to show only what happens to people. Or to people who got cash, but also to people who didn't, and to local firms and to local prices and wages. And everything is going to be sort of one whole system that's going to logically work out. And that's really important because we do want to understand these sort of aggregate economy-wide impacts of demand stimulus or cash transfers in this type of model. So that's what we're going to do. Before we do that, again, are there any questions?
Hey, Dennis, I have a clarification question. So, would you get data
You get data for
for everybody? Like, because you were saying that you are getting data, you are going to see what happened for those ones who receive and not receive this transfer. So, I assume that you are, at the end of the day, you are getting data from not only recipients, right?
Yeah, so in the empirical paper that the GE paper, we certainly did, right? We had data from recipients, from non-recipients, from ineligibles, from firms, from markets, from prices. I'll describe the data that we have. The point here I'm trying to make is that you want the model to be general equilibrium. This is not a fact about the data, it's about the model. You want the model to be a sort of macroeconomics model, a model that models everything that's going on in the economy, including the impacts on prices, the impacts on markets, like firms switching between markets and buyers choosing where to buy because prices going up and down. So you want to model all of these forces if you really want to understand what happens in general equilibrium. Because we know already, right, that giving money to some person is not only going to affect them, but it's also going to affect their neighbors and prices and firms and so on. So our model wants to reflect that. That's all I was trying to say. Sort
Cool.
of
Yes, that
why
makes
a
sense.
spatial general equilibrium model. Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay, so what's the idea here? I'm going to.
Dennis, a quick question, Dennis. This is Miriam.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the slides that you presented. There's one where you showed that businesses that had one person had more Slack than larger businesses.
Yeah.
And then you also said businesses that are based in the home state also had more
Yeah.
Slack. Is it possible that we shouldn't therefore be very worried? Because most times home-based businesses are not capital intensive. And so you have this one person with their business in the home state, and when they have no customers, they're busy doing other things around the home.
Yeah, I mean, this is really sort of speaking to what is the source of this underutilization. You're right, in the homestead, it's maybe easier to combine having a business and doing childcare or working on the farm or doing other things. And so maybe the slack here is not so costly, right? I agree with you. That might also be another reason for why there's more slack, because maybe, time here in these for these workers is more valuable because they can be doing other things. So at a sort of high level, these are just think of these as sort of motivating facts. It's like we want to write down a model that sort of captures this idea that, this is something about small firms and one-person firms and in these types of sectors. And we're going to say what one way of explaining these facts is with these lumpy inputs, that you have to have at least one worker. You cannot hire 0.3 workers or 0.6 workers, or you cannot have half a machine. You need at least one. And that's obviously much more important for a one-person firm, because going from 0 to 1 or from 1 to 2 is a very big jump. But going from 50 workers to 51, that's not going to lead to a lot of underutilization of the 51st worker, right? And so it's just motivating this idea. Now, homestead villages are also not, homestead enterprises are also for the aggregate economy here, not the predominant place where people sell. So sort of rural markets, villages, and urban markets, that's where most of the revenue is generated. In fact, you'll see in the rural area, even about half of the firms we have are in markets. And so quantitatively speaking, the fact that we see one-person firms, even in busy Nairobi markets and in rural markets where most of the sales are happening, suggests that for the aggregate economy, this might still be a worrying issue, right? And this is why we write the model, and this is why we quantify it to tell you exactly, how much does it matter quantitatively? That's basically the idea. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Dennis.
Okay. It's a great question. And at the end, we'll sort of get back to alternative, like what could be other reasons for slack? We're not saying this is the only reason there's slack. There's other reasons. And we'll get back to that in the end. But the sort of idea that slack then generates big multipliers, that will carry through. Okay, I'm going to spare you equations. And I'm going to say in this model, there's agriculture, which is boring and normal and freely traded. And then there's the services sector. And really the idea here is this. Don't look at the screen if you don't like equations. It's really the idea that you can only hire one workers, two workers, three workers, not 1.2, not 0.5. You can't hire them part-time. You can just hire one or two, or for a day or for a month, and not for half a month, and so on. And so if you only need additional 0.3 workers, you still have to hire one worker. And sometimes you're then not going to fully utilize that worker. That's really what this minimum idea here says. Okay, so let me show you in a graph. So here's a firm, and at the bottom this is firm productivity, or let's call it firm demand. And in the beginning, this is a one-person firm here, N equals one. And they have more and more and more demand. And on the left, you see utilization. So at the beginning, this worker works 40% of the day, and the rest of the time they're waiting. And now they get more and more and more and more customers. And then at some point, they work the full day. They cannot serve any more customers. Now they could hire a second worker. In this model, they don't do that immediately. For a little bit of, because it costs, they have to find them and there's a cost to it and have to pay them a wage. So they're going to wait. So first, what they're going to do, they're just going to raise prices for a bit. That will mean, yes, fewer customers are coming, but they're going to raise prices just as much to keep demand so that they keep being fully utilized. And then at some point, they have so many customers, they're going to start hiring the second person. And here you see with the second person, utilization goes down again because the second worker is now not fully working all the time, but it never goes back to the case where you were the single worker. And in fact, the larger and larger the firm gets, the smaller and smaller this is a problem, right? Because from going from 5 to 6 workers, you're not going to actually make that big of a step. And so at some point, you're sort of back in this old case where these integer constraints don't exist. And so this is sort of one of the reasons why you see more underutilization in these small firms, because the steps are just much, much bigger for small firms. And then we put this in general equilibrium, so skip this. But basically, in this economy, the income of people is going to be the wages they get from working for somebody else. This is going to be sort of the hiring wage, and then there's a piece rate. They also get profits from running their own firms. They also get income from agriculture, and they get a cash transfer. We add the cash transfer because now we want to sort of model the gift directly cash transfer in this setting. There's also going to be the wages are going to be equal between agriculture and businesses. So people are going to decide, should I work on my farm or should I start a business? And so on. Okay. So really sort of think of this as your typical rural economy setting. So what does the supply curve look like? This is what I mean by a convex supply curve. Convex means it gets steeper and steeper and steeper. So let's spend some time on this. What this model generates is that on the left here, when you're in a sort of remote economy, when there's low demand, you have very, very flat supply curves. That means you can increase output without raising inflation or prices by a lot. But if you give more and more and more cash, or you get more and more and more urban or more busy markets, at some point, all firms are fully utilized. And you cannot increase output in this entire economy. If everybody's fully working, there's no other way, there's no way to increase output because everybody's working, right? There's no productivity gains here. And so at some point, you have a vertical supply curve, meaning if you give people cash, all that's going to happen is inflation. This is different from the standard model where you always just have a vertical supply curve. And so the idea is that when you have underutilization or slack, you can have these flat supply curves, and you can therefore have these big multipliers. When you sort of increase demand here, you can get a lot of extra output as an economy and very little increase in prices. Okay. Great. Then we put this over in space. I'm gonna skip this for you. It's basically now there's going to be different locations, and people are going to decide which markets to shop at based on the prices they face, and they're going to start businesses in different markets, and so on. But what does this model now tell us about cash transfers? If you give now a big cash transfer into a local economy, first you're going to see a reduction in slack and an increase in productivity. And this is not because people get more productive or they invest in better machines or they get training. No. It's simply because they're using their time more effectively because they're utilizing their time when they're at work or their machines more productively, right? So it's basically a free increase in productivity from cash alone. You're also going to see real multipliers, economic multipliers larger than one, which is not typical in these macro models. So part of the reason why we wrote this model is because we wanted to write a model that can rationalize these large multipliers. You're going to see bigger output or lots of increases in economic activity where, well, in places which have a lot of slack, like in small firms, low utilization firms, in remote areas, and in sectors which have the lowest utilization, right? So in manufacturing and services and so on. And you're going to have much lower inflation than you would think. The last thing is in this model, because we have both agriculture and the services, you're also going to see a movement out of agriculture. Structural transformation. So people will move from working on their farm to working in the services sector, non-agriculture sector, starting businesses and so on. Why? Because now they can do so more productively because they have more demand and they have higher wages there. And so it becomes more attractive relative to agriculture. And so, you know, let's take these predictions and try to match them to the GIF directly experiment. Can I ask, does anyone not know the general equilibrium effects paper or experiment that we did in Kenya? Maybe just raise your hand. Okay, I'm not getting any responses, so I'm assuming you guys know. So basically, this was in 2014. This was in 2014, a big Gift Directly program across basically 653 villages. This was an RCT. It was a very unique RCT because it randomly varied not only which villages would get it, but also the saturation. So in some regions, two-thirds of villages got it, in other regions, one-third. And what this allowed us to do is to sort of estimate not only the direct effect on recipients, but also on their neighbors, so non-recipients, on local prices, and so on. The cash injection in this program was about 16% of village level GDP. I know that now when you're doing universal programs, this is going to be much larger, and poorer regions is going to be larger too. But this is what it was in Kenya. It's still quite a sizable increase. So about one-third of households got it, and then about for those households, it was about half of their annual income. So that adds up to 16% of local GDP. So what did we find in the empirical paper? But first, we found that recipients had a big consumption increase, right? So basically, over about a year, year and a half, they spent everything. I think this is typical of all of the GiveDirectly programs. That led to a big increase in local production. So they spent it locally. Local firms had higher revenues. Those revenues went back to local owners of these firms as higher profits. And these profits they spent again, and then wages went up too, and then they spent it again. And so there was more money flowing in the entire economy. And basically, this led then to a real to a multiplier of 2.4. So for every dollar that GiveDirectly transferred, there was a $2.5 increase in local economic activity. There's also very little inflation. So in the empirical study, we measured a sort of less than 1% inflation. What was striking is in our firm survey, firms had 40% higher revenues, but they didn't hire any more people. They didn't really buy any more machines. There was a bit more like inventory and stock that they purchased, but also not that much. And so the question is like, how were they able to sell so much more without hiring more workers, buying more machines, investing into anything sort of that would meaningfully increase their productivity? Well, our story or our conjecture is, well, it was slack, right? Maybe before they were working 4 hours out of the 8 hours they were sitting there. Now they're working 6 hours of the 8 hours they're sitting there, but they didn't need a second worker. They didn't need a second posho mill in every village, right? That's sort of the idea. And now we're going to make this sort of precise in this model. So how we're going to do this, where we're going to estimate this model quantitatively, and again, this is super, super structural, and I'm going to spare you this, but the idea is we're going to try to make the model work quantitatively for this economy. And then we're going to replicate exactly in the model this experiment. And then we're going to see what does the model say should happen. And we can going to compare it to what we found with the RCT, with this sort of empirical approach. And we're going to see, can the model match or fit what we found empirically? And if it does, we're going to say this is a good model, and then we can start using this model for other purposes. What's sort of cool here is that we pre-specified all of this. We said, here's our model, here's how we're going to estimate it, and here's everything that we're going to try to match. And I'm going to show you everything we pre-registered. That's really novel because macroeconomists don't usually do that, but we're quite excited about this, and it should just sort of increase your belief or credibility of these results. Okay, so now how does this experiment work? This is Siaya County in Kenya. There's 400,000 households. These are all the dots, the households living in Siaya County from our census. They live in sort of 653 villages, which were part of the experiment. These are the dots here. Five towns. These are sort of mid-sized towns that were excluded because at this time, GiveDirectly was only working in rural villages. And then there were 200 villages that were excluded because, for some reason, GiveDirectly had worked there before. There was other reason. Some of them were treated, so the red ones here are treated, and you see the gray shaded area was the two-thirds treatment, and the others was the one-third treatment. So you have sort of local variation in how much money went into these regions. If you think of this in terms of households, this is how it looks like. The eligibles are in red, and then the treated ones are in dark red. Now, these household, they shop at 71 markets. So all the stars here are the markets, the weekly markets, and you see they're sort of spread all around. People typically shop at one or two markets, typically their closest one. And what we have in our data, and this is sort of super exciting, is in the household survey, we asked, where do you shop and how much do you spend at each market? And basically what you see here represented is exactly that. So we know who shops where, and therefore how much exposure to the cash program randomly did each market get. We have 20,000 firms. Some of them, as I said, operate in villages, some in markets. About half of them operate in markets. And again, what's sort of really cool is we know where the owners of all of these firms live. And so we know how much of the revenue of the sales in each market go back as profits to the owners of these firms in the village. And then again, from that village, they're going to go spend it at a market and so on. So we can fully trace out the flow of the money from when people get it to where they spend it to then profits and wages going back to employers and more employees and owners. And then they spend it again and so on. And this is all going to be represented in this model too. just to sort of as a background, this is a super cool and rich data environment, which is why we're using this. It would probably be cool to think about what is the minimum data requirement that we need for us to fit this model to a place where you guys want to go and work in the future. And I'd love to work with you guys on this to sort of see, can we operationalize this for a setting where we might not have that much data? But here it's super cool because we do have a lot of data. I'm going to skip you that. That's like 7 months of work, 7 seconds to skip it. And basically, I'm just going to argue that first, the model fits very, very well to baseline. So basically, here we're showing true market share versus model, and it looks quite good. The model fits the shopping patterns quite well. So one thing for you to think about is 80% of people's spending is within 4 kilometers. So again, if you walk to the market, yeah, you're not going to walk much further than 4 kilometers. And that's sort of what you see here. There's a steep gravity here. Most spending is very, very, very local. And that's certainly important. And so this is something to think about collecting for future types of study areas as well. And we matched a firm size distribution. So both in the data and in the model, firms are very small, mostly one-person firms. Okay, so now we're going to sort of in this model, we can now say we have the model also has all of these regions and they're all in this full geography. And we can now say, let's drop some money into this toy economy. And what does the toy economy say? And what did our experiments say? So the model says you should get a multiplier of 1.8 and inflation of 1.3%, which then leads to a real economic multiplier of 1.6. As I've already told you, in the data, this multiplier was 2.4. Now, we think this is exceptionally good for a model of this kind. Here we only have one friction in the model, and we already get within the confidence interval, and we already get very, very large. For this literature, 1.6 is a big multiplier. I should sort of tell you the 2.4 is really one of the largest ones empirically measured, and it was surprisingly large, and that's why sort of the macroeconomists were like, give us a model that can even get close to that. We can with this one friction. There's other frictions that we are not modeling, which could get us even closer to 2.4, but that's not the point of this paper. We're just going to say, just the fact that you have this integer constraints and underutilization and small firms can quantitatively match very, very large empirical multipliers. Now, how would that look if you, instead of, treating only a third of people, you had treated all people, or if you had given more money? Well, you're going to run up that supply curve, and you're going to go from the flat to the steeper part, but actually it doesn't get that much steeper that quickly. So even if you had given 60% of GDP, the model says you should still get a multiplier of 1.4, 1.5, and inflation would go up maybe, to 6%. But you'd still get a kind of a sizable positive multiplier. And that's really, really cool for us to show because it could have been much steeper here. It could have looked very, very different. Now, does the this is the headline finding. Does the sort of mechanism in the model, does that also align with what we found in the data? So I told you, right, that what you should see, if the model is correct, is that you should see more output increases. So firms would be able to sell much more in places which had a lot of slack or low utilization to start with. Well, we find that exactly in the data. The biggest output response were in manufacturing and personal services firms. You still have pretty large output responses in the other sectors, but smaller than in these sectors. And those are precisely the sectors that had the lowest utilization. Conversely, with inflation, where would you see the biggest inflation? Well, if the model is right, you should see it in places which had the highest utilization. So in the most central, the urban, the busiest markets. Well, guess what? That's exactly what we find in the data too. We find the highest inflation in data of like 1.5%, rather than sort of 0.5 or even less in the markets, in these sort of urban markets that had the busiest, that were the largest and had the highest market access. And so we basically just think the model is doing quite a good job at understanding or replicating what happened in this economy. Just two other things we match quite well. Wages increase both in the model and in the data, and there's a 10% reduction in the hours that people work in agriculture relative to non-agriculture. And this is again documented in the UBI study and in our study and everywhere. So the model does really well on all of these aspects. I'm going to skip this because this is sort of a technical term thing, but basically I'm going to just skip this. The point we're trying to make here is that using structural modeling compared in addition to RCTs is going to really help us understand what's going on because RCTs cannot answer all questions. In particular, they cannot answer this missing intercept problem. So what if prices go up everywhere in this entire Siaya County because of the experiment? Then even your low saturation control group are still going to have higher prices, and you cannot really ever estimate from comparing treatment and control what the real inflationary impact was because inflation went up everywhere. So what you need is a sort of a comparison group that's outside of the study area, or you need a model. And basically, we show that with a model, you can say, you know, we basically capture, we missed 20% of the income gains in the experiment, and we missed 50% of the inflation gains. So we basically probably underestimated a bit what the inflationary impact of the program was in Kenya. It was really small. It was less than 1%. So even if it's twice as large in reality, it's still small. So it doesn't matter. But still, that's sort of an important point to make. The next thing is we can do distribution of welfare. Now, first, I'm going to show you the income gain for across all villages now in the model. This is not in the data. This is in the model of villages that received money. Now, of course, all of them benefit and some benefit more because they got more money than others. And so on. Now, what happened to untreated villages? Well, nice thing is the model says everybody still benefited. There's like one village which is just at zero, but basically, you know, control villages benefited as well, not quite as much, but they still benefited. So everybody was better off. This is a great bottom line for your guys' program. And lastly, now we can use this model, and I'm gonna close it there very shortly. We can now use this model to sort of say, what would multipliers be if this model is correct in other regions? How should we target cash transfers? And we're going to do a few things. Reassuringly, you know, if we had no integer constraints and no reallocation or nothing in the baseline model, we have a multiplier of one and lots of inflation. But we don't have to go that extreme. If we just reduce transportation costs, which would mean that we're sort of in a more urban area, it's kind of like, you know, going from rural markets where everybody's far apart to an urban area where there's lots of customers and markets, the multiplier would come down by a bit. It would still be above one, but it'd be lower. The multiplier would be a bit higher if we targeted regions which had the highest slack to start with, and it would be a bit lower if we targeted the largest, busiest markets. So the takeaway from this is that like our model will say that you should get biggest multipliers in the most slack, most remote regions, and smaller multipliers in sort of urban areas. And you should get more inflation in the busiest urban markets and less in rural areas. Okay. Now, to conclude. So we've basically showed you that slack or underutilization is important for development. It's related to firm size and market access. We've said there's one reason for why there might be slack is this indivisibility constraint, the fact that you have many small firms that have to hire lumpy inputs. And we've showed you that this replicates relatively well the large scale RCT for Megaregulator. It helps explain why we have these large multipliers and slow and low inflation, and it's consistent with additional evidence. Now, what does this mean, right? And I'm hoping to sort of take us from here now. This was the academic paper into a sort of broader policy discussion now. So the first point I'm trying to say is in this model or in the way we think about it, slack or underutilization is not laziness or is not a choice or is not people are sort of being stupid in any way. No, people are acting optimally given their context and their constraints. Transport costs are high, right? There are many small firms, right? And so it's not, I think this is a really important point to make. It's also a feature of technology, right? If you have bigger weekly markets, if gig work is possible, if you can coordinate with your customers over mobile phones, if transport gets easier, if machines that are smaller and more fitted to the context are available, or e-commerce, then all of that would reduce slack because it would improve the utilization of existing factors of production. And it's just to say that this is not something that's always there, or it's there because people make wrong decisions. No, it's something that can change. The second, and we've touched on this already, is you don't have to believe completely our integer story. And our integer story here is the only friction. There could be other reasons why there's even more slack, right? In particular, there could be complementarities with other inputs. Maybe workers aren't fully utilized because there's a power outage, or they can't get supplies, or supply chains are disrupted, or there's a flood or something like that, right? So if that's true, there's even more slack, right? It could be because of uncertainty or volatility or seasonality in demand, right? If they could better predict when customers come or coordinate, or if agriculture wasn't so seasonal, then maybe they could better utilize their factors of production. This is certainly something I'm thinking about a lot with Youth Directly programs going forward. It may also be just as a result of competition for customers. So, you could say, I coordinate, I'm only open four hours a day, that's fine. But then you might lose customers and you don't want to do that. So you prefer to be there 8 hours a day, even if you only work 4 hours a day. And so it might be something about the competitive environment. And also sort of there might be this underlying involuntary self-employment. So for some of the time in the agricultural calendar, at least, you might prefer to have a wage job. There isn't one available. So you decide, okay, I'm just going to run a bit of a retail enterprise or something. But that's not really because that's primarily what I want to do, but it's because I have to do it because there's no other alternative. And that leads to there being so many small firms. So all I'm trying to say is there could be other reasons for slack. The implications of all of these are the same. If there is a lot of slack and underutilization, you're going to get large multipliers, and we should take this serious. Lastly, and this is important for you guys, I guess, in how you think about the aggregate impacts of your program. And the more and more I think about this is that it all comes down to supply. So in this model, in this world where everybody's already fully working and all factors of production, all machines and all workers are fully utilized, you give more demand, you give people cash, they cannot produce more. They're already producing at maximum capacity. They're already fully productive. Then your Give Directly experiment is only going to have redistributive impacts. The economy cannot grow. It's not going to grow. It's just going to benefit recipients and hurt non-recipients through inflation. In a world where the supply elasticity is very flat, you can get large multipliers and you can have real benefits for everybody. And so really this sort of from the macro perspective, this sort of small RCT evidence is useful. But really, what we need to think about is how is it possible for this economy to be able to meet the additional demand that you guys are creating with the cash? If everybody wants to buy more maize, where is this maize coming from? If everybody buys a mattress, where is it coming from? Who's selling it? And so really, all I'm thinking about these days is these supply curves or these supply chains. And so there's other reasons beyond slack why supply may be more or less elastic. So remoteness makes or bad supply chains may make it hard for your program to have the best possible effect because basically prices will have to rise more. Seasonality is important. Maybe when everybody's working very hard on their farm, it's very difficult to produce extra output in that high season because basically everybody's fully utilized. And this last point, and I'm sure you've thought about this, is this is all unless people use the money to actively increase supply by becoming more productive, by getting training or education or starting firms or buying seeds and fertilizers. So that whole sort of investment response is really important too. And lastly, I want to say this is all about the short run. In the long run, we of course want to know what's the long run multiplier? And we're working on this with this team as well. Now we're doing a 10-year follow-up and we're going to sort of see how does it change investment into human capital, like health and education? How does it change market structure? Do these markets change permanently over time from this one-time shock? We have sort of tentative answers that say yes to all of these things, but we're going to try to quantify them going forward. I know I went a bit over time, so I'll stop here and please, any inputs or questions are very welcome.
Thank you, Denis. The presentation is great. I think Maggie has a comment. You can unmute yourself and ask the question.
Hi.
I see in the you. Yeah. Hi, Maggie. How's it going?
Hi, Dennis. I'm doing well. Yeah, I don't know if this is too broad a question, but thought I'd shoot my shot. I'm on the US team, but I worked in GD International before as well. But yeah, in the US, as I mentioned, we don't saturate. There might be a lot of people who apply in Houston and will select low-income people randomly. Yeah, how would you begin to extrapolate these findings?
Houston is a huge city, and you guys are probably treating very few people within Houston. And so basically, my first approximate guess is that you're not going to change prices or rents or wages in Houston as a whole, because it's too big, and your treatment is such a small share of local GDP or production that you would never be able to pick this up. This is what I would say quantitatively, so I wouldn't worry there too much. This is more something to worry about with these rural programs, where you really inject a lot of extra money. People are spending in Malawi, we're finding they're spending 50, 60% more in over the first 4 or 5 months after receiving the transfer. And if everybody gets it, where are the markets getting 50% more supplies from? That really starts to become a really interesting question. In the US, yeah, I wouldn't think so much about the multipliers. There might, of course, still be multipliers, but they would be very difficult to measure. They would be quantitatively very small on a per person basis, because your program is relatively small compared to the whole. So I would just trust your RCTs and your simple treatment versus control comparisons there, and not worry too much. Does that help?
Yep, thank you.
Then it's a very quick question. I know we're on time. Looking at the slides where you compared the model to the actual data, I noticed that the model sort of significantly underestimated the changes in wages. Do you have a reason for this?
In wages, I
Yeah, I
mean,
believe it's
so,
that, but yeah, wage, yeah.
so, so basically, this is a very noisy estimate, is my answer. It's within the confidence interval. But so that's one thing. The second thing is its selection. So in the model, we don't have different types of workers or different types of work. In reality, of course, we do. And people stop working on the least paid things first, right? They stop working on their neighbor's farm for weeding and other low paid types of activities. And so the wages of people that actually keep working after getting transfers go up by more than the average wage in the economy, because the sort of the cheapest or the worst types of jobs start disappearing, and people are not working for a wage. People have to do it themselves on their own farm. And so that's sort of why this is sort of conflating both the selection, the fact that now the jobs that are for which wages are paid are better jobs, which is good, of course. But that's why wages go up as well. So those are the two reasons I would give. It's very, very hard to write a model where wages go up by 20% and inflation doesn't change, in a setting where capital is very, not very prevalent. Most are just labor-based personal service firms. So how can they pay 20% higher wages charging the same prices? So that's very, very difficult. But still, in the model, of course, wages go up much more than inflation, and that's a really good thing. And previous models couldn't get that.
Perfect. Thank you, Dennis.
Next question. Can the model tell us anything about how spillovers may change if a greater share of the economy is agriculture driven? Yes, it can. So one point I want to make about this, I said this one doesn't ever really get very steep. And the reason why this doesn't get very steep is that there's a lot of agricultural workers, or a lot of people spending time in agriculture, that as soon as the non-ag sector, which is where most of the cash is being spent, is growing, people can start relatively easily new firms and move into that sector. And that's why prices and wages don't have to rise so much, because there's this reservoir of lots of people that mostly work on their farm that can start working in the non-ag sector. That dampens the inflationary impact, right? If there was a fixed number of retail firms and they had to sell twice as much, that would lead to much more inflation than if you also have this big agricultural sector that can draw in additional people and start new firms, and they can start selling more. And so basically, with more agriculture, you'd sort of, in this model here, see a flatter increase in the in inflation with the share of GDP treated. It's not quite that easy because at the same time, compared to the baseline non-services or non-ag sector, the cash transfer would then also be a larger share of that sector. And then, you know, it depends a little bit, but we can certainly run simulations for them. I think the biggest thing where agriculture is going to make a difference is on the supply side, is this idea of what kind of productive investments could people do with the money, right? In our setting, all of the fund action is in the non-ag sector, and this is because our model focuses on the non-ag sector, and it's consistent with our evidence. But in an agricultural setting, if people can invest in fertilizers and better seeds and agricultural assets and become more productive because of that, that's a supply increase, and that's great. That's then sort of a multiplier that's coming from this side, and not from the demand side. It's not the focus of this model, so I don't want to overstress it. But there, I would think very carefully about what productive investments people are doing. I hope that answers a little bit your question. I think Alif, this is sort of relates to what I just said, huh? Do we track new entrants? Yes, in the short run, we don't really find much new entry. And what's really interesting is the people who, in the Kenya study, the people who got money, the firms which were owned by people who got money and the firms which are owned by people who were non-recipients who didn't get money, both grew by the same amount. So in the non-ag sector, really this investment stuff didn't play out at all. It's like every firm benefited equally, regardless of whether people got money or not. And that would not be the case if people got money and they said, okay, I'm gonna invest in my firm, I'm gonna expand my firm, I'm gonna become more productive. No, we didn't see that. If people got money, they spent it, and firms grew because people were spending it everywhere, not just in firms of recipients, but also of the non-recipient. That doesn't have to be true everywhere. It may be true that in other settings, people do use the money to become more productive or to get training or get better equipment and so on. We just didn't find very much of that in Kenya. Most of it was demand driven, and this is also why this paper focuses on the demand side.
Thank you, Enis.